Well, last week we introduced a man that maybe some of you have never heard of before, George Counts. But we started talking about how he was so influential in the area of education and even in economics and politics. And we had a little PowerPoint going here, and we talked about a lot of the influences that were around his time. Just quickly, we talked about the Reconstruction time period after the Civil War. We talked about the progressive education movement and the progressive political movement that sought for everything that is... Anybody remember? What are the progressives like? They want something that is new. Anything that's new, we're going to go for. Anything that's old, throw it out. Main idea there. Optimism, the Roaring Twenties. We've just had the great victory in the first Great War. Everything seems to be going wonderful. This is the time period that George Counts was growing up in. He began his education around 1915, 1916 at the grad school of the University of Chicago. We talked about some of those influences there that we'll review quickly, and how it led him to have a different perspective on American education. He's a frontier thinker. He was in a famous teacher at the Teachers College in Columbia. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of that, but at Columbia University, it is a very famous, well-known teachers college, and that is there. And a lot of the big, progressive, radical even educators and professors teach there. And he was, of course, there for probably 25 to 30 years teaching. And his goal was to have a new social order through education. Just quickly, we talked about some of these influences. He was the first person to major in educational sociology, that we can change society by using education. We discussed that last time with Charles Judd, his big teacher. They did some research projects together. When he began to research America and secondary education in America, remember we talked about he saw this big discrimination. He saw this big gap between the poor and the rich. And, you know, we hear a lot about that in today's society. What was even talked about way back. And he was one of the first to begin to recognize and be concerned about that. The social barriers. Again, this is some of the first times that these things are being discussed. You know, education used to not be concerned with this. Believe it or not, education used to be concerned with learning, learning academics, learning the basics to get a good foundation, the tools of learning, all those things. But here, Counts is beginning to see, oh, we got to have a sociological influence. We've got to stop these gaps. We've got to stop these social barriers that are coming in that are hindering people from learning, and more importantly, are hindering us from constructing a brand new, progressive, cutting-edge society that is inclusive of all people. We're going to deal with some of those things today. We talked about how he went over to Russia. He visited for 8 months. He did some economic research there. And he was very impressed with communism. Of course, he only saw one side of the communism while he was there. Like I said, it's kind of like those people that visit North Korea and see, you know, the one side and think, this is great over here. What's people's problems? And everybody else is living in poverty. But he saw one side of communism and he said, I love their approach of economics. I just don't agree with their violence and the revolutionary overthrow. We don't want that, you know, but we do like this all-inclusive egalitarian philosophy that they had. Of course, when he got back from that visit and he was, you know, America's in all this optimism, we talked about the Great Depression that came. And of course, Counts uses this as his springboard to really attack the American economic system that was currently in vogue, and that was, of course, capitalism. He says, oh, there's all kinds of problems with capitalism, because look what it did to our country. We're in this Great Depression now. So he used that as an impetus to continue on. He wrote The American Road to Culture, Education, and Social Construction, again saying, if we don't want this Great Depression to happen anymore, if we don't want this stock market crash to happen anymore, we have got to reach out educationally and change the way our young people are thinking, so that by the time they reach their adulthood and they're in their prime leadership, whatever they end up doing, they aren't making the same mistakes that those mean, old, greedy, terrible capitalists made in the 1920s. The main thing we want to talk about today, as we started last time, is this book that he wrote in 1932. It was the revolutionary work. Again, it's a small little pamphlet. It's only that big. You could probably sit down and read it in 30 to 40 minutes if you're a good reader. It was a compilation of three speeches that he would travel the country and he would give these speeches to college students. He would give these speeches to teachers. He would give them anywhere he could, and he decided, you know what? Nobody's listening to me. I wonder why. So he said, I'm going to put it in print form and we're going to send it out all over America. And the book was read by many people in 1932. It was a dare. Dare the school build a new social order. He realized, as we talked about, so many people have latched onto this philosophy that if you want to change a society, if you want to change what a country is doing, you have to reach the young people, the youth. You have to, I mean, that's what Hitler did, right? I mean, same thing. It's been happening since history began. You reach the youth, and by the time they reach leadership, they're making the changes. They're putting them in. And he knew that the school was going to have to be a key to reach this new social order. Now, as he began, we're on the bottom of the page of your handout there, if you want to just fill in a few things that we're going to remind of. The first part of the book is basically an attack on progressivism. And when I first started reading the book, I was like, well, that's pretty neat. He's attacking progressivism. This is great. Because progressivism has strange ideals, and they believe in child-centered, you know, that the child naturally will learn on his own and all those kind of things. So don't restrict him. Don't teach him. Don't put him in a strict environment where he has to memorize something. Don't put him in competition. His feelings and self-esteem might get hurt, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, oh, he's attacking progressivism. That's good. Well, he attacked progressivism for certain things, but he still believed the progressive philosophy. He just said, the only thing wrong with progressivism is that they say the teacher is not to impose things on the student. His idea is we've got to impose something on the student because we want the social order, the society, to change. If you want it to change, you have to impose a belief system on the young people. And that, to an extent, is true. If you impose and indoctrinate them in certain things, they will make the changes because it will be normal thinking processes to them when they grow up. Normal thinking processes. He believed that with, you know, focusing on the intellectual, the progressives' education is intellectual, and education for social adaption there on the bottom of the page. He believed that, yes, it must focus on the intellectual, but students have been robbed of purpose in life, was his idea. So we've got to impose a purpose on them, or these students are going to graduate high school and graduate college, and they're going to be self-absorbed with themselves. Because think about it, progressivism teaches child-centeredness. That you teach yourself, you do what you want, you do what interests you, you do what you like. Like we said last week, put a kid in a classroom, let him explore on his own the things that he naturally likes, and he's going to learn all kinds of great things. And like we said, that's the most foolish thing I've ever heard. If you try to put 5- and 6-year-olds in a classroom and just let them explore, that's going to be, it's like, I think Dr. Hobbs used to say, if there was a rock on the outside, the kids will find it. You know, they'll throw the rocks on the roof, or they'll find a rock somewhere and they'll throw it through something. If you want to clean out some pebbles on a baseball field, just take a bunch of 5-year-olds out there. They'll be pelting each other and doing all kinds of stuff. They're not going to sit down and learn on their own. They're not going to do it. They're going to be peeling the paint off the walls, doing handprints here and there, and mopping the floor with paint and all kinds of crazy stuff. If you don't believe me, never mind. We can take a vision into some classrooms in America if we need to. But he said, so they're learning self-absorption, so when they graduate, what are they going to do? They're going to be absorbed with themselves, and they're not going to be concerned with society. He said, that's one of the problems with progressivism. They've got to graduate and be concerned with, instead of their selfish endeavors, they have to have a mental capability that reaches to the society. He said they have to have far-reaching purposes and plans for social construction. So he said progressivism is good in some ways, but because they emphasize self-centeredness so much, society is never going to progress. And he believed that we've got to change the society. Now, he talks about some of his ideas with progressivism down there on the bottom. Turn the page to the back, please. And let's talk about some other things that he talked about. Counts proposes that the teachers are the key agents of change. I'm going to fast forward here a little bit, sorry. We talked about this already. That was the chart on the bottom of the page. If you need some of this information, I have it written down. I can get it to you later. But imposition, this is about where we left off last time. It's necessary in education. You've got to impose something on the child. And he's going to talk about the teacher next, of why the teacher is an important tool in this imposition. So what is the teacher's new duty? He's not supposed to be allowing the child to explore, like the progressive said. You can do that to a certain extent. And he would never even suggest the traditional way. You know, you would never put children in a seat. You would never do the multiplication table drills. You would never do the spelling word drills. I love walking in the hallways sometimes and hearing the first graders. I really like the third graders when they start doing their multiplication tables, and they have to go to all the tables, and they have to do it in like a minute or something, isn't that? And they get brownies or something if they do it in a minute, so the kids are all excited, and they're drilling. Oh, how dare you drill those poor kids with memory work? They need to be allowed to explore on their own. Well, Counts wouldn't even believe in memorization and drilling and competition and all those things. But he's saying, instead of the progressive idea, instead of the traditional idea, I've got a brand new idea for the teacher, a new duty for the teacher. Let's look at it. Here's the quote from his book, and we're going to talk about this. That the teachers should deliberately reach for power and then make the most of their conquest is my firm conviction. That is a very famous quote from his book. What's he talking about? What power is he talking about? The power for the teacher to be able to impose whatever philosophy they want on the child. The progressive would say, don't impose the power. Let them do what they want. He's saying, let's go a step farther. We need them to impose. We need them to grab that power to be able to teach whatever philosophy they want, whatever societal issues and sociology and all those type of things. We've got to impose those things and take that power. Listen to this next statement. I didn't put it on the board, but after he writes that sentence, he says this. To the extent that they are permitted to fashion the curriculum and procedures of the school, they will definitely and positively influence. Let the teachers make the curriculum, whatever they want. Let them make the procedures of whatever they want. They will influence the, now notice he's not going to say the academic mindset, the IQ brain power, the ability to learn, nothing like that. What are they going to influence by doing this? They're going to influence the social attitudes, the ideals, which is what you believe in, and the behavior of the coming generation. Now that, to me, is a very, very powerful statement. Has nothing to do with teachers influencing with academics and everything to do with if I change their social attitude. In other words, we're not going to have this gap between rich and poor. We're not going to have this discrimination and all these other things. And we're all going to be on the same level. We're all going to be equal. We're going to change that attitude. Then we're going to take from that into a new belief system. And what is the last thing he said? And the behavior. If you change their social attitude and if you change their belief system, what automatically changes? Their behavior. Why is the crime rates in America skyrocketing? Why are the juvenile detention facilities full of young people? Ricky Dunsford always talks about, so one of the saddest things he does is go to the juvenile centers where these children have no idea who Adam and Eve are. They have no idea what the flood was, who Noah, basic things that we would take for granted and think every kid should know that. These kids don't even have a clue what the Bible is. Why? Because a social attitude was changed and a belief system that says the Bible is ridiculous, that was imposed upon them. So what do you think happened to their behavior? It went into the criminal activity, it went into to terrible living. And then we have to start changing the ideals again to excuse that terrible living. You know, laws, it's funny, I always hear on the news every now and then, or I see news stories that, you know, believe it or not, this state, whatever state, has had on the books for the past 200 years that it's illegal to get a divorce. It's against the law. Or some states have had these things on the books where it's against the law to live with your boyfriend or girlfriend. And people go through the laws and say, well, that law's been here for 200 years. We need to get rid of that. What? That's the way people used to think 200 years ago. But what did we do? We changed the social attitude. We changed the belief system and the behavior changed. So instead of correcting the behavior, we changed the standards. We got it kind of backwards here in America. And it's happening every generation, and every generation takes it a little farther and makes it worse. So this power of imposition, here's the kids in the classroom, college, high school, elementary, whatever. They're sitting in the classroom. The ability for them to be impressed, the ability for them to be molded and to be imposed upon is there. The power's there. So teachers, you've got to grab that power of imposition and impose upon these students some sociological attitudes that are going to change the future and construct a new society. Now, what are we going to do to find out? We know they need to grab the power, but what are they going to impose? That's a big question. And Counts answers that in his book. He's almost like, well, I'm glad you asked. Let me answer that for you. Before we do that, let's go up and make sure you're filled in on some of these blanks. I know I get kind of scatterbrained here. The top of the page, number 3, imposition is necessary in education. You may already have that. I think we talked about it last week. Imposition is necessary in education. Teachers must therefore reach for what? Power. Reach for power and impose principles of democracy for the construction of a better society. Number 4 is that statement I just read, if you want to follow along. Number 4, teachers must influence the social attitudes Number four on the top of the back of the sheet, teachers must influence the social attitudes, the ideals, and behavior of students. Through an emphasis that is economic. You may think that sounds crazy, but we're going to talk about it in a minute. Through an emphasis that is economic rather than political. And like I mentioned last week, we're going to draw a distinction between political democracy and economic democracy. Counts worked really hard to change that definition, and he succeeded if you look at modern America, in my opinion at least. Notice that in number four there, there's nothing mentioned about traditional disciplines. There's nothing in here about mathematics, history facts, learning how to write, learning how to read. That's not mentioned. No traditional disciplines, but we've really got to get their social attitudes changed. We've really got to get their ideals changed. We've really got to get their behavior changed. Now notice, where would the typical American child learn his social attitude, his belief system, and his behavior from? From home. And from the church. And if he went to a good one-room school or something, the school, those three things, but the home is primary. And so what is he trying to do? The school is going to take over the job of the home, and it's going to take over the job of the church. I listened to an interview that Arne Duncan, anybody know who Arne Duncan is? He is the Secretary of Education. And he did this interview where he said, I just foresee a beautiful future for education where the American education system, the public education system, is the center of every city, of every community, of every village, that our schools will be community centers, he said, where if kids wanted to come at 5 a.m. and stay all day and even eat 3 meals a day there, and they can have their fun there, and they can talk with people there, and they can hang out there, that is going to be the center of the community. What used to be the center of the community? The church. Well, let's get out with that mess. We're going to put the school there. Why? Because they're not stupid. They know that we can change forever the face of America by changing the young people. And they're going to work to do it. There's some radical ideas out there, and it's shocking. It's shocking. Let's move on. Look at number five. Here's some things that Mr. Count starts talking about when he deals with this economic system here. A redefined economic basis here. There's the three things I put up there. Sorry if you wanted to see that. That's the blanks for number four. Change the attitudes, the ideals, and the behavior. That's going to be the new curriculum. So we got to rewrite the textbooks. We got to rewrite and train the teachers a different way. They've got to be sensitive to culture now. They've got to be sensitive to society. They can't be thinking this academic stuff. That's a bunch of baloney. Society no longer needs political structure, it needs economic structure. Again, why would he say that? He's coming out of the Great Depression. He's seeing the fallacies of capitalism. He believes that communism is a better way. So he's going to bring in a new economic, and he's going to do it through education. We hold within our hands, listen to this, the power to usher in an age of plenty, to make secure the lives of all, and to banish forever poverty from the land. Sounds like he was giving a speech yesterday, doesn't it? This was in 1932. We have it within our hands, the power. Again, what's that power? Who has the power? The teacher does. And we're going to use that power to bring in an age of plenty. The American dream. We're going to have this. Secure, protect it. Make sure everybody's lives are secure. So is it no wonder that FDR did the Social Security thing, the welfare and the food stamps? Why are we doing all this stuff? Because we literally in our American minds believe it is the responsibility of the society, of the government, of the school system, of everybody to make everybody else's lives secure. It's our responsibility to banish poverty from the land. It's our responsibility to bring in an age of plenty for everybody. This has been a mantra since the 30s, and it took them several years to get it through, but now it's normal. That's normal, commonplace things right here. It's literally almost every time I go into the store, there's someone using some type of government funding, and I'm not opposed to helping people that need it, but I get kind of ticked off when the lady was in front of me one time, and I got kind of upset. I just bit my tongue. She had just bought a bunch of wine and all this stuff and paid cash for it, and then she ran her stuff with her food stamps, and it came up like a dollar 40 short. And she was furious at the point of cussing the cashier out. I was like, I got a quick fix for you. Let's return some of that wine and let's pay for your food for your kids, if that's what you're going to do with it. People think I'm too harsh. I'll be quiet. Let's continue. Number five, let's talk about this redefined economic basis. He talks about the American dream. He talks about how the American dream accidentally happened. Look at number five. In the past, the American dream happened to occur accidentally. As people worked hard, they were pioneers. The country was just being started. Boy, they had to work hard. They had no other choice. And they accidentally fulfilled the American dream without even knowing it. They overcame class barriers. They worked so hard, they weren't just the lowly apprentice anymore. They were now owning the company. America's great. American dream can happen. But here's what he says, number five. Industrialization, however, has bound citizens to classes. Now we've got this industrial society with factories and companies, and there's a boss in a company, there's a CEO, and then there's these other people that work for minimum wage, and then these other people that have their own business. And so you've got classes of society, the rich, the middle, and the poor. That is a big no-no. This is why society is going to fail, because we've got division in society. So he says this industrialization has bound them to classes, so a new system is needed. And we need democracy, but not a governmental form. Not a governmental form. Let's talk about this. Number six, a democratic system will change economics. A democratic system will change economics, and this must be taught in schools. And that's what he said in his book. We've got to teach democratic economics. And you think, well, democracy is pretty good. That's what I started thinking when I read the book. Oh, we like democracy. You know, it's the people get a say, the people get a voice, you know. I tell the students in class sometimes, this isn't a democracy, this is a dictatorship. You don't have a say. Sorry. We like to think, you know, all right, let's all vote on this. Let's all say on this. And, you know, sometimes it's fine for that, you know, going out for whatever. And say, hey, who wants to go to Dairy Queen or McDonald's? It's going to be Dairy Queen, right, Kevin? You know, we can vote on things. You know, democracy, we have that power. And yes, in a way, America has some democratic principles. And I thought, well, he's pulling for democracy. That's got to be good. Until I realized that his definition of democracy is way different than the definition of democracy that I was taught in high school. You know, rule by majority of people voting and majority of people having a say and the people being involved. This isn't what he's talking about. And sadly, as we think about America today, every time you hear our president say, I'm for American democracy, he's not talking about democracy that you and I think, the democracy that you and I were taught when we were in high school and college. He's talking about the democracy that George Counts redefined. What is this new democracy? Number seven, it is not a political governmental form anymore, but it is moral equality. He flat out says it in his book. Democracy is moral equality. Democracy is not that everybody gets a say. Democracy is that everybody's equal. And the problem is our schools aren't teaching children that everybody's got to be equal. And if we can teach them all that equality is the most important factor in society, then when they get into society and become leaders, they're going to do everything they can to make things equal. Look around America today. We can't stand it when something's not equal. Well, except unless you're a Christian who believes that, you know, ISIS should be destroyed or something. It's unbelievable. It's more important than learning math. It's more important than learning history. It's more important than learning how to drive a car. It's the most important thing our kids could ever learn is that we've got to be equal. And when we go out in society, we can't do anything to hurt somebody else or to make them think that we're more important or more superior than they are. And this is in the 1930s. And yes, people thought he was crazy. And we're going to see in a few minutes that he still won with a silent revolution. But let's finish here. Number seven, democracy is not political. It is moral equality. I want you to have a copy of this. I want you to read it with me to see this is directly from his book. Directly from his book. There's an important paragraph in here that I want you to see. And as we read this, I want you to think about America right now I want you to think about the things that are discussed in the political debates. I want you to think about the things that our politicians argue about. I want you to think about the things that are on the news almost every single night as I read this paragraph and you follow along. So democracy is equality, social equality. I'm going to start reading at the very top. Democracy should not be identified with political forms and functions, with the federal constitution, with elected officials, or universal voting. To think in such terms is to confuse the issue as it has been for generations. The most genuine expression of democracy has little to do with our political institution. It is a sentiment with respect to the moral equality of men. It is an aspiration. What's that? That's like a dream, a goal, towards a society in which that sentiment will be totally fulfilled. Boy, his goal, his aspiration is that everybody's equal. Continue. A society fashioned in harmony with the American democratic tradition, which he thinks would combat all forces tending to produce what? Social distinctions and classes, repress every form of privilege and economic parasitism, manifest a tender regard for the weak, the ignorant, the unfortunate, place the heavier and more onerous social burdens on the backs of the strong. Glory in every triumph of man and his timeless urge to express himself and to make the world more habitable. I'm sure things are burning through your heads right now. Exalt human labor of hand and brain as the creator of wealth and culture. Provide adequate material and spiritual rewards for every kind of socially useful work. Strive for genuine equality of opportunity among all races, sects, and occupations. Regard as paramount the abiding interest of the great masses of the people. Direct the powers of government to the elevation and refinement of the life of the common man. Transform or destroy all conventions, institutions, and special groups inimical to the underlying principles of democracy. And finally, be prepared as a last resort in either the defense or the realization's purpose to follow the method of revolution. Just think about that for a minute. They're doing it. And we're going to talk about some of this later, but I want to quickly hit on this while it's fresh in our mind. The things that stood out to me, a bunch of them did, but a tender regard for the weak. People get so castigated if they don't help the poor. Now, I know in Pensacola we got tons of people that are always standing on the streets and taking money. You know those people make tons and tons of money? A man's talking about one, and he told me later, that man, he said he refused the job from his dad. His dad offered him a job to get him off the streets. You know why he refused the job? He makes three times more that salary by panhandling on the side of the road. Now, I'm not against helping people. But if you dare in our society say, well, I don't want to help him. I'm going to give him money because he's just going to use it. The guy's a drug addict, the particular one. He's just going to use it for those kind of things, and I just would rather not use my money for that. Oh, don't say that. You terrible person. Why? Because we're supposed to have a tender regard. Yes, we are. But we take it to the extreme. Now, here's the one that really got my goat. Place the heavier and more onerous burden on the backs of the strong. If I have to hear one more time say, the rich need to pay their fair share. I heard a commentator say that the rich people in America, those that make like $200,000 or more, they pay 95% of the taxes. 95% of the money that goes to the government is paid by those people. If that's not a fair share, then what is? What is? And they're still crying for more. Why? Because it's not fair. It's not equal. Glory in the timeless urge of man to make his world more inhabitable. Climate change, radical environmentalism. This is where it comes from. This is where it started because this stuff right here, people thought he was crazy. And they laughed him off the scene. And you know what he did? He quietly went to the teacher's college. And he started writing papers and publishing works and teaching teachers and writing textbooks that then went into the public school system in the 1950s and they got gobbled up. And the next thing we know, this is what we all believe. Why? Because if I get to the young people, I construct a new social order, and it's happening, it has happened, and it is continuing to happen right before our eyes. This is like reading a prophecy before it was fulfilled or whatever. You know, it's like he went forward in time, saw it was going to happen, came back and wrote it. It's unbelievable. Some of these things. Direct the powers of government to elevate and refine the common man. That is the government's job to make your life better. It's the government's job to take care of you. That's the new social order. Because if you leave it in the hands of those greedy capitalists, there's always going to be division. But if you let the big old government step in and take over, everything's going to be wonderful. Everything's going to be equal. Everybody will continue to be happy. And here's the kicker. My jaw hit my desk. And then I got real fiery in my paper I was writing and started preaching. It was bad. Listen to this now. Right there. Transform or destroy all conventions, institutions, special groups inimical to the underlying principles of democracy. What democracy? If you're against the equality of all men, we are either going to transform you or destroy you. You're not for equality. We're going to destroy you and remove you from society. This was written in 1932, people. The churches, you can't say anything. You business owners that want to stand for religion, you need to shut up. You're against moral equality. Why? Because the special groups of America that were culled out of the colleges to be put in the higher levels were taught this, and now they're the ones in charge. And I would dare say probably the majority of America doesn't go along with this, and the majority of America maybe feels sorry for the business owner that has a shutter shop down. Maybe they do feel, but the people that are in charge and the news media, they promote this stuff. Last thing, and if nothing else works, we got to have a revolution. I don't want to do what Russia's doing now. We don't want their communism and their revolution. But if it's the last resort, then we'll have a revolution. We'll get rid of these crazy Christians and nuts that stand against moral equality. Things start coming together now when you see what this man did. This one little pamphlet changed the direction of American education forever. Let's continue. Fill in some of these blanks for you. Capitalism, number 8, prevents moral equality because of its selfishness and greed. That's what he taught. It prevents moral equality because of its selfishness and greed. Number 9, a collective society. Everybody's equal. Everybody's sharing. Everybody's on the same page. We take our money from the rich and we give it to the poor, just like he said here. The onerous burdens have to be borne on the backs of the strong. They have to do their fair share because they're better endowed. Number 9, a collective society devoted to the common man must be built through proper education. If we educate them, we can change them to be collective thinkers. Now I'm going to quickly go through letter B here, a few things. He then promoted the cause of the new social order. Now I said, people thought he was a nut. People accused him of being a communist, rightly so. People laughed him off and said, this is ridiculous. This guy needs to get out and shut up. So he did, but he did it quietly. Here's some things that he tried. First, capitalism fails the pragmatic test, it no longer works. That's what he said in his book. Common man's interests. We just discussed those points. Now, let's talk about how he promoted this cause. First, the teachers' college in Columbia. He went there and taught for many, many years. And while he was there, letter B, number 1, he wrote The Social Frontier. For 3 years, he was involved with editing and putting out those articles. They went to teachers all over the country, to professors all over the country, and he promoted this social agenda just quietly, undercurrents in what the teachers were reading, what the teachers were being taught, what the teachers were believing was this communistic socialism. He had some political endeavors. I've got them there, 2, 3, and 4. He ran for Senate. He had a teacher's party. He wrote another book in 1952. I'm going quickly, Education in American Civilization. He wrote this after World War II, and he said, well, we've even progressed more with our technology, so now we can use our technology to further, number 4, eliminate discrimination. The whole point of that book he wrote in 1952, after the war, was we've got technology, we're advancing, we need to use it as a great tool to eliminate this discrimination against people. And this was right before the 60s when these things began to be in vogue. Now let's talk about, lastly here as we close, the quiet revolution and some political evidence that there was a quiet revolution. Again, they laughed at him, so he went into quiet. But the revolution that he wanted still happened. It just happened quietly. And the next thing you know, 40 years later, you wake up and boom, America's totally different. How'd that happen? Here's some things here. Politically, remember what he said? Combat all forces tending to produce social distinction in classes. So number 1, he had a disdain for discrimination. A disdain, number 1, for discrimination and the promotion of equal opportunity. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to have what he said in 1932, and then down here in each one I'm going to give you what our current paradigm. How would you word this today? Here's what he said. Here's how he put it today. Discrimination, equal opportunity. You hear about it all the time. Here's the next thing he talked about. Place the heavier, more onerous social burden on the backs of the strong. How do we talk about that today? Income-based tax code. Why is there an income-based tax code? So the wealthy, the strong can pay the heavier burden, their fair share. It just makes you sick. I'm just tired of hearing it. They are paying it. Next thing. Tender regard for the weak, unfortunate, the ignorant. What do we call that today? Welfare, unemployment, redistribution of wealth. All these things are happening in our country. Welfare, if you try to take that away from people today, you're going to have a riot. You're going to have chaos, craziness. I got my phone. Don't take that thing away from me. They give them everything. Try to take it away and watch what happens. That's what he talked about in 1932. Here we are, 2015, what, 80 years later. Last thing, or a couple more things. Make the world more inhabitable. Climate change, environmentalism, conservationism to the extreme. They're always wanting to take more land, to conserve land. I heard on the budget of Florida, the state budget, they're fighting about how many millions and millions of dollars to give to land conservation. I thought it was interesting last week, by the way, when we were watching that film, of how the forest fire made the pine cones open up and grow more trees. You know what? God's got it all figured out. And we get in there, this isn't fair and equal. We're going to fix everything. We're going to fix society. God's already got it under control. We're going to trust Him. At least as Christians, that's what we're going to do. They won't. Transform all conventions, institutions, and social groups inimical to equality. Hate crimes, they're all over. It's unbelievable that somebody can get so destroyed in the media and mischaracterized over saying something that was hurtful. And people can go out and rape women and murder them and get out in 5 years. Now, is there something wrong with that? Having a moral sin is more terrible to people today than an actual crime. Their minds have been indoctrinated to believe that. And that's scary. What are some educational evidences that this revolution has taken place? Just quickly go through these as we close. That's letter B on the back of your sheet, Roman numeral 4, letter B. The traditional education says we're going to passively transmit culture. As we teach, yes, the culture just passes on from one generation to the other. Yes, it does. But what does the modern education say? We're going to be the leading agency for societal reform. We can change society as teachers. The education system can change it, and that's what they're out to do. Next thing, traditional education believes in the three R's. Reading, writing, and arithmetic. You know, if you spell writing wrong. Maybe they should have put spelling in there. Three R's and an S or something. The three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Just teach the facts. Teach the basics. But what do we have today? Social sciences. Now, you may not think that's a scary thing. You may not think that's a big deal. I want to read something let me find it in here real quick, wrote about social sciences. All right, this came from a book that I have written by a man named Knight. Here's the social sciences. He said, no longer would the curriculum be centered upon traditional disciplines, but a textbook shift would focus on social sciences. This happened in the 50s. He lists them as anthropology, economics, sociology, political science, and psychology. Why? Listen to this. They better identify major problems of controversy, conflict, and inconsistency. Those subjects are better at making man equal than teaching them to read and write. Take reading and writing away from them, then they're just a dumb society anyway, and all they'll think about is equality. Traditional education says the responsibilities are with the states. Student achievement. What is modern education? Common core. Let the government tell you what to teach. Let the government make a unified curriculum. And then this egalitarianism. We don't want student achievement. The progressive educator, if he walked into the classroom and saw our fourth grade teacher doing an oral speed drill where the students were competing with each other by row or something to see who can get the answer the fastest. I did that with the algebra too. I got those oral drill cards that are fun, Tara. And I went there to algebra 2. I said, y'all think y'all smart. And I said, here's the sixth grade. And you have to go like 10 plus 2 divided by this plus that times this. And they were just like, but they got it eventually. At least a few of them did. But the progressive educator would be so upset at that. Why? Because those students are competing. Oh, it's terrible. Little Johnny's not going to win. Sorry, John. Not going to win. And he's going to go home and cry to his daddy. And his daddy's going to handle it. Self-esteem is more important than learning truth. Learning truth. Let's look at the bottom of the page here. For the believer, what are some things that we should do? We need to understand that this is going to happen because it's Satan's plan. It's going to happen. He wants to unify society. He wants to make them equal. We need to understand that Christian education will be viewed as inimical to democracy. Remember what we read there? That all society, all institutions that are inimical, that are against democracy, moral equality, will be shut down, transformed, or destroyed. Christian education is against moral equality. What's going to happen? We're going to face some stuff in the future. We need to be prepared for it. It's in the Lord's hands, but we need to be prepared for it. What's going to happen if Christian education is stomped out of this country? Well, then I'm going to take my kids and take them home and teach them. You got to do what you got to do to teach your children. This is why I'm telling you, kids in a public school are getting a social agenda. Take the blinders off. It's happening. I don't want my kids in that. And number three, understand that the Bible and its principles are the hope for true unification. How can we truly be unified? How are we truly equal? Who's it through? To Lord. Well, that's the answer. Sorry, Mr. Counts, you got it wrong. Society doesn't make people equal. Christ does. Because you know what? We all the same thing in Him. We're all dirty, rotten sinners, saved by the blood. We're all the same. And that's the answer. Here, as Counts was old, 80-something years old, this is what he wrote in the foreword to one of his friend's books. This is one of the last things he wrote before he died. Let us proceed, therefore, to rear a generation of mavericks. Rebels, basically. Now, who in their right mind would take and have a child and say, you sweet little two-month-old baby, I want you to be a rebel. Maybe that's what my mom said about me. I don't know. To rear a generation of mavericks, a generation capable of doing what? Grappling boldly, intelligently, and creatively with our swiftly changing world. We got to always be rebellious to what's going on. Always. That's the only way society is going to succeed. We've got to stop there. I hope that this is beneficial to you. It was eye-opening to me to see that 83 years ago, this little tiny pamphlet so drastically has changed the face of American education permanently. I'm sorry, I'm a pessimist. There's no hope for the public school system. I'm sorry. I thank the Lord that in the 1960s, the Christian school movement started. In the 50s, actually. I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful. 1962. That Dr. Hobbs had enough sense to see what when the... And the Lord helped him, I'm sure. Guided him, gave him wisdom to see, this is crazy. I'm out of here. What can we do? We can start Christian schools. And no, Christian schools aren't perfect. And we got to be faithful. And we got to hold things to the truth. And I'm telling you, we better continue to teach not this moral equality junk, but to teach what is the truth. And let that truth just begin with God's Word and flow right out from it. So I'm thankful that we have a school. Continue to pray that the Lord will protect us because this is coming. It's already here. It's just going to get bolder and bolder. Father, thank you for the privilege we have to be here this morning to talk about these things. And Lord, I pray that it was a blessing to our people here. Help us to be more prayerful and to relying on you for the future of Christian education. And Father, I pray that you would just continue to speak to our country. We don't know, Lord, what's going to happen. It seems so hopeless. But we know Christ. We have hope and joy in Him. But Father, I pray that we continue to know true equality and true unification through our Savior. And we look forward to that day when we won't have to worry about society and all this stuff because the Lord's going to be in charge, rule and reign. And we just look forward to that day, Father. May you quickly come and send your Son in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you.